Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to a new series of Reading Our Times, the podcast about books, about ideas about us. This series, we're looking at playing God, science, religion, and the future of humanity. We're going to be talking about scientific immortality, alien life, animal personhood, the rise in mental ill health, and the soul of AI. And underlying it all, we're going to be thinking about the question that lies at the heart of Reading Our Times. How are we to understand our human condition? In June 2022, a New York court had to decide whether Happy was a person. Happy was a 51-year-old female Asian elephant. She was, by all accounts, an impressive animal. Sensitive, intelligent, and the first Asian elephant unambiguously to have passed the mirror test. She'd been resident in Bronx Zoo for most of her life. Her legal case was not some weird eccentricity. It was brought by the Non-Human Rights Project, an American organisation dedicated, in its own words, to challenging an archaic, unjust legal status quo that views and treats all non-human animals as things with no rights. In this instance, they failed, but they haven't given up with Happy, and there are many other animals, including chimpanzees, African elephants, and even dolphins and whales held in captivity, whose legal personhood they are seeking. Will they succeed? How far can we draw an impermeable line between ourselves and other animals? Do other animals show signs of personhood? It's sometimes claimed this question in particular can be answered empirically. Watch what animals do, and then we'll get an idea of whether they're persons. But of course, in order to do that, you've got to know what you're looking for. In other words, the empirical question has to be preceded by a philosophical one. Whether animals are or can be persons requires us to wrestle with the thorny question, what is a person? Mark Rowlands is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Miami and the author of a number of books on the philosophy of mind and the moral status of non-human animals. And his recent one, entitled Can Animals Be Persons, is the subject of the podcast this week. Mark, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Thank you, Nick.
I began my introduction by talking about the attempts of the Non-Human Rights Project to get various animals recognised as legal persons. So I guess one of the really important things to begin with is disentangling legal personhood from what you call metaphysical personhood. Now, I'm conscious that could be a very big question, but what's the difference, simply put?
Metaphysics means literally that which comes after physics, but it also means pertaining to what something is. So there are various definitions of persons you find in the philosophical literature. Probably the most famous and the one I tend to work with is Locke's definition, 17th century English philosopher John Locke, who said that a person is a thinking, intelligent being that has reason and reflection and can consider itself the same thinking thing in different times and places, which it does only by that consciousness which is inseparable from thinking and seems to me to be essential to it, it being impossible to perceive without perceiving that one perceives. Cutting through all that, I think what we get is the idea that of a person is something where four different features coalesce. There's consciousness, cognition or reason, self-awareness, and memory, the ability to consider itself the same thing through time. Where you have those four things in a single individual, I'd be tempted to say that's where you have a person.
Yeah, and the legal personhood that organisations like the Non-Human Rights Project are trying to get recognised in the law, that's basically parasitic on that metaphysical personhood, right?
It's complicated because, as Oliver Wendell Holmes put it, the life of the law is not logic but experience. And by experience, he talked about the felt necessities of the time, the biases and prejudices and so on. These all work their way into the law in various ways. So it's notorious, for example, that the law has both extended personhood to things which don't seem to be persons corporations,
rivers and
ships,
that kind of thing. Yeah,
that kind of thing, yeah. And on the other hand, they've not extended personhood at various times to individuals which clearly do seem to be persons, members of other race and women being, you know, the obvious examples.
Yeah.
But one would hope that eventually the metaphysical and the legal concept of a person would eventually merge, and so we have a sort of concomitance between the two.
Yeah, and where experience and reason actually match.
That would be nice, yes.
Yeah. So you mentioned those four conditions of personhood. Mm. You talked about consciousness, cognition or reason, self-awareness and memory from Locke. You draw on those four, but actually for the last one, you talk about other awareness. Just unpick that for me. Why did you go for other awareness there? And what is other awareness compared to Locke's idea of memory?
Yes, other awareness is the one point of deviation from Locke's theory because he doesn't talk about it. The reason I incorporated it is because I was trying to operate with a concept of personhood that would be as acceptable to as many people as possible. And so some people in their definitions of persons had this other condition called other awareness. You have to be aware of others as persons as such. I'm not sure that's actually a condition of personhood. I adopted it basically for sort of strategic reasons.
I want to unpick those four because they are central to your argument, central to the book. But before I do, can you just pinpoint the difference between consciousness and self-awareness? Because a lot of the time people use those terms almost interchangeably, don't they?
They do, and it's a mistake. So by consciousness, what I mean is what philosophers sometimes call phenomenal consciousness, which is the way things seem or feel to you when you have an experience. So, for example, I see a bright flash of lightning, then things seem bright and flashy to me. I hear the lightning alarm, things seem loud and jarring, temporarily confused. I stub my toe, let's suppose, then things seem or feel painful to me. So phenomenal consciousness is the way things seem or feel to you when you have an experience.
And this is what philosophers call qualia, is that right?
Qualia is one way of unpacking that idea. It's a particular theoretical way of explaining what's going on, and not everybody likes it. I believe in phenomenal consciousness, for example, but I don't really believe in qualia because I don't think that's the best way of explaining what phenomenal consciousness is.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, there is a close association between the two in the minds of many.
You say that you judge consciousness by watching its effects almost. I think at one point you say like judging the wind. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, that was my attempt at answering a problem known as the problem of other minds. The problem of other minds is this: how can we know what's going on in the mind of something else, such as an animal? The same problem arises, of course, for human beings, and that's how the problem was initially stated. How can we know what's going on in the mind of someone else when all we can ever see is their body and their behavior? And standard solutions involve sort of the idea of inference. Well, we infer what's going on in their mind from observation of their behavior. There are various sorts of problems with that. I prefer a sort of direct perception view that where we basically see what's going on in the mind of another. So the example I talked about was when we see dogs playing with each other, and there's a certain sort of sequence of behavior that's required to get this up and running, so it doesn't escalate into a fight. So the dog does various things. It lowers its front and raises its rear and so on. The goal of these is to convince the other dog that we're just playing. Things that would ordinarily be aggressive, no, this is just fun. That's the idea. When you see a dog doing that, what are you seeing? And you can't simply say, well, you see the dog playing, because his efforts to play might in fact be unsuccessful. He doesn't manage to convince the other dog that they're just playing. What we have to say is that what we're seeing is the dog trying to play. And trying is a mental state of a certain sort. And so in those sorts of circumstances, we can see what's going on in the mind of another dog, because there is no real separation between the mental and the behavioral in those sorts of cases.
Yeah. But it's certainly more straightforward to infer that the animal in question, your dog or perhaps my cat, does have intentionality, is thinking things through, does have desires and so on and so forth, than the opposite, which has been surprisingly mainstream view for a great deal of the past, which is that animals don't think, don't have intentionality, right?
Yes, I mean, that has been the mainstream view, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if it reverts to being the mainstream view in the near future. But at the moment, the science of animal behavior has thrown off its so-called behaviorist shackles, where all we could focus on was the behavior and not talk about minds at all. And it's a lot more sort of liberal in that sense now.
But it also makes more sense. I guess the point I'm trying to get at here is that I think you make the point that it just makes more sense to infer that these animals do have some kind of consciousness.
Yes, that's right. To take an example, there's a certain time in the evening when my dog will sit in front of me. I'm sitting on the sofa. He'll sit in front of me and he will stare directly at me. And in those circumstances, I know that he wants one of two things. Either he wants to go out the garden or he wants to jump up next to me on the sofa. He's a very polite dog in that way. He always asks first. And I would be willing to bet my house and all my possessions on one or other of those two being the correct explanation. So that would be an inference to the best explanation.
And one of the other themes that runs through your book is that we shouldn't demand higher evidence or better proof from animals than we require of other human beings.
And yes.
We naturally infer consciousness and mindedness to other human beings through the way they interact with us, putting aside the business of language, which I know we'll come on to at some point. Why would we deny it to animals? Fair?
I think that's exactly right. It's an interesting technical problem when it applies to other humans. And how to solve it is not entirely clear, and different people have different ideas. But if someone really took that problem seriously, suspecting that all their friends, their family and so on didn't have minds at all, they were just kind of robotic entities of some sort. I mean, we would generally take that as an expression of a mental illness, not sort of philosophical acumen.
Yeah.
And so to hold animals to higher standards than humans seems to be unwarranted.
It's almost as if in this issue, humans are innocent until proven guilty and animals are guilty until proven innocent.
I think that's very perceptive, actually. I think that's exactly the attitude that has generally been adopted.
So I can certainly buy the idea that animals, non-human animals, are conscious. Let's look at cognition or reason or rationality, which is the second of your four criteria. You quote David Hume early on saying, "No truth appears to me to be more evident than that beasts are endowed with thought and reason as well as man." Now, your book is a book of philosophy, but there are some lovely examples there of animals showing causal reasoning. Can you just give us a few of the examples?
Yes, the masters of causal reasoning are birds, but particularly corvids, the family that includes crows, ravens, magpies and so on, who are very good at making tools basically to use. So there have been various studies done on New Caledonian crows in particular, which seem to be the best. And they're capable of not only using tools which are made available to them, but constructing tools in order to solve particular problems. Typically, they're trying to get a morsel of food from somewhere that they can't reach. For example, there might be two different sticks. So they can use one stick, but it doesn't reach. And so what they have to do is find a way of putting the sticks together, bending them into hooks and so on, and the sticks are obviously designed so they can be put together. It's not a major manufacturing job or anything like that. And some of them, you'll see, they'll stare at the apparatus, they'll stare at the food, they'll stare at the apparatus for over a minute, and then they will just do it.
You give one example of a crow that paused 110 seconds before examining a new task. I love that. Yes. I wish humans had that level of patience.
Yes. It's right.
Yeah. But mammals as well, chimpanzees, famously tool users.
Yes, they'll make spears to hunt bush babies, and they will form primitive pounding devices in order to extract things from palm trees and so on. Probably my favorite, because it's the least expected, was the American alligator, who, when birds are in nesting season and they're looking for twigs and so on, will arrange for twigs to rest on their snout in order to attract a nesting bird, which they will then eat.
Impressive. How do you respond to the challenge to that, that this isn't reasoning, it's just habit? And after a prolonged period of time, I realise that option A is successful and option B isn't successful, and therefore I adopt option A.
Yes, but that does seem to be a form of reasoning in itself. You compare two different options that you've had experience of, you identify one as being more successful than the other, and then you adopt it because of that. So that seems to be reasoning.
Let me just push back on that in that, you know, if I've got two doors in front of me and one of them opens and one of them doesn't, and I can continue trying to push the one that doesn't open until I try to push the one that does open, need I have actually thought about that? Can't it just be trial and error?
There is an interesting debate in the study of animal minds at the moment about the sense in which animals reason in the way we do, or the extent to which they adopt various just strategies. A heuristic. So, for example, there's a reasoning test for animals which is designed to test for what's called exclusive disjunction, disjunctive syllogism, basically. So animals are presented with two options, a container A and a container B. Food is placed in one. This is done behind a barrier, so the animal can't see which one it's going into. But then the animal is shown the empty canister afterwards, and then it's given the option to choose. So the idea is, if it chooses the non-empty canister, some would say, well, he's engaging in disjunctive syllogism, a form of logical reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
There are various ways of responding to that, and I think your response is a kind of example of that. Some would say, well, perhaps they're not reasoning logically, not reasoning deductively, they're just adopting a heuristic such as avoid the empty cup. So you don't have to draw a logical conclusion about the other cup, you just have to avoid the empty cup. There are reasons for thinking that won't apply in general, but I think a more sort of plausible scenario would be one in which animals don't reason deductively, but they do reason inductively, they reason probabilistically. So if you're shown an empty cup, then this raises the probability of the other cup being the one you want, and so on, and so you go for that. It's not quite the same thing as deductive reasoning.
Mm.
I mean, it's true that if the probability goes up to one, then you've got the certainty, which is kind of like deductive reasoning, but it's not quite the same thing. If that's true, and I think there's good evidence for thinking something along those lines, it's difficult to find overwhelming evidence of deductive reasoning specifically in animals. But if that sort of reasoning is true, then they're reasoning, they're just not reasoning deductively, they're reasoning inductively or probabilistically.
Yeah.
Which also raises interesting questions about what humans do when they reason deductively, as we put it, whether we're doing something all that very different anyway. But if you accept that reason sort of encompasses various things, not just deductive reasoning, but also inductive and probabilistic and abductive reasoning, then it seems that animals are capable of reasoning in that sense,
yeah,
and therefore qualify as rational yeah, in that sense.
And that goes back to our earlier conversation of not expecting more of animals than we would have expected of ourselves. It's,
yeah,
it's very,
yeah,
tempting to say, well, humans are fantastic logical reasoners until you actually observe us not doing so.
Yeah, I mean, we're terrible at formal reasoning in general, you know, and it may well be this because our brains are not really suited to it. Our brains are probabilistic engines, and I think probably the reason we're better than other animals at deductive reasoning is because we have available to us a sort of external symbol system which we've incorporated into structuring our brain, which allows us to at least simulate these sorts of operations.
Hmm.
But it's very noticeable that the sort of things that, say, digital computers are very good at, formal reasoning, we're very bad at, and the sort of things that you can explain in terms of mental models and probabilistic occurrences, things like facial recognition, for example, we're much, much better at.
Yeah.
So I suspect in the end, there's probably not a huge difference between what our naked biological brains do and what those of other animals do. The deductive stuff comes in because of this massive external structure of language and other formal systems that we've built around us. I think that's a difference.
I mean, just from an evolutionary point of view, you'd expect that, wouldn't you? Because it's not as if we've taken a very different evolutionary trajectory up until the point in which we became linguistic cultural animals, in which case something very different happened. Before then, similar path.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Yes, I think the big change came in with the development of external systems. So it wasn't a biological or evolutionary change so much as a change in our environmental scaffolding.
Well, again, we touched on language there, and I'm going to return to language at the end, but I want to look at the third and fourth of these areas before we do so. The third was self-awareness. Now, much of the time when people are thinking about self-awareness, particularly in this context, they're talking about intentional self-awareness, and they will cite the mirror test, as indeed I did in my introduction. First of all, tell us what the mirror test is.
Well, the mirror test was developed by a guy called Gordon Gallup in 1970, and it was put forward as a test for self-awareness. So the idea is you find an animal, you anesthetize it, you put a little mark on it in the form of dye or something like that, and then when it comes around, you place it in front of a mirror. The dye mark has been placed in a spot that's only visible using a mirror.
It's like your forehead or something like that.
Forehead would be great, yeah. That's a typical place. And then you find out if the animal scrutinizes itself in the mirror. The idea is if it does, then it must recognize itself as itself in the mirror and therefore has self-awareness.
Yeah. That has become a mainstay for these tests of whether non-human animals or some of them are self-aware. You've got problems with that, haven't you? Or you think we rely on it too much?
Well, I think there are two forms of self-awareness. And when Locke, who we began with in his definition, talks about recognizing yourself as the same thinking thing in different times and places, it says, which it does only by that consciousness which is inseparable from thinking, and which seems to me to be essential to it, it being impossible to perceive without perceiving that he does perceive. That's at least gesturing in the direction of a very different form of self-awareness. Because typically, I mean, here I am, I'm looking at you on the screen, I'm not thinking. And this would be a form of reflective self-awareness. I'm not thinking, oh, here I am looking at Nick on the screen. I'm just looking at you and we're engaging in conversation without thinking too much about this. You know, most of the time we just get on with things without thinking about what we're doing. But I think there's another form of self-awareness which is built into any form of conscious experience at all. And it's difficult to grasp, but here's my effort at explaining it. After this is over, I'll go and take my dog Shadow for a walk along the canal. And the canal is littered with scores of iguanas, which he loves to chase, and they jump into the canals who are on the other side and so on. And sometimes he misrecognizes things as iguanas, misidentifies things as iguanas. So a little bit of tree detritus, for example, might present itself to Shadow as an iguana if it's shaped in the right sort of way. So when you think about seeing something as an iguana, the question is, well, what's involved in that? And the basic idea is that, well, you see something as an iguana, even when it's not an iguana, because you've made various guesses about how your experience will unfold if certain circumstances were to occur. So when you see a piece of tree detritus as an iguana, that is because you have anticipated, for example, that if you were to charge up to it, then it will retreat or run away in some way. And when it doesn't, you're forced to revise your guess. So seeing is a matter of guessing about how things are going to go, is the takeaway so far. The thing is that these guesses, they always involve implicit self-awareness, awareness of yourself, because you're implicated in the guesses. So it's not, for example, that the iguana changes its position in Cartesian space, moves from these coordinates to those other coordinates that's crucial. It's that he moves in this way relative to Shadow, my dog. If Shadow is to, say, the east of the iguana is facing a certain way, then what's crucial to his expectations or guesses is how the iguana will change its position in space relative to him. And so the idea then is that you're implicated in the various guesses that allow you to see. So having a conscious visual experience involves various implicit anticipations about how future experience will unfold, and you are implicated in at least some of those anticipations. And so there's a form of self-awareness built into having any conscious experience.
So it's a kind of non-intentional self-awareness.
It goes by various names, because this has cropped up in the history of philosophy.
So just to clarify, the Locke quote with which you started this answer is, by your reckoning, just putting too much emphasis on what we call metacognition, on thinking about thinking. And self-awareness doesn't need to be thinking about thinking. It can be a more pre-reflective or non-intentional form of awareness, right?
Yeah. Yes, but I don't think Locke was guilty of that mistake. I think many commentators on Locke have interpreted him in that way.
One of the problems I have with that is that would it not be then impossible to impute that kind of non-intentional self-awareness to very, very simple organisms, the way in which they move and operate and, you know, move towards positive stimuli, move away from negative stimuli, looks for all the world like it's a kind of non-intentional self-awareness. And yet I wouldn't really want to impute personhood to, you know, an amoeba.
Yes. On my view, you'll have non-intentional self-awareness only when you'll have intentional experience. If there's any kind of thing going on consciously in the case of an amoeba or a mussel or oyster or something like that, then I would be inclined to call it sensation and not experience. And it's sensation because it's not intentional. It's not about something. So we have intentional self-awareness only where we have experiences that are intentional in the philosophical sense that they're about something or other. So Shadow's experiences were about iguanas or pieces of tree detritus that seemed to be at the time iguanas. So there's this directness towards the world, and our awareness of ourselves, our non-intentional awareness of ourselves, is built into this directness towards the world.
Our last of the four, and then we'll kind of pull our strands together, is other awareness. We've touched on that already. Tell us a bit more about what other awareness means.
My discussion of other awareness piggybacks on the distinction between intentional and non-intentional self-awareness. So the idea is you can be intentionally aware of another, or you can be non-intentionally aware of the other. So intentionally aware is when I see another person and I say, oh yes, there is another person, something along those lines. That's just straightforward other awareness of an intentional sort. But there's a kind of experience that we can have that captures quite nicely what I mean by non-intentional awareness of others. And it's the kind of experience made famous by Sartre when he talked about shame. Sartre is very difficult to read, but he does offer some very nice examples, which I think are sort of useful to hold on to. So he when he talked about shame, he gave an example of someone looking through a keyhole at a scene behind a door that they're not supposed to be looking at. Initially, the person is just absorbed in the scene. They're not thinking about what they're doing. They're just absorbed entirely in the scene going on behind the door. But then they hear footsteps, and then the focus of their experience changes. They're no longer the subject of experience looking at what's going on. They're now an object of someone else's experience. So they experience themselves as a voyeur, perhaps, or something along those lines. This is an example of experiencing yourself as an object for the other. So to do that involves a kind of awareness of the other, which isn't captured by the standard intentional form of awareness. So the argument then is that animals are capable of this form of non-intentional self-awareness, which involves basically experiencing themselves as an object for the other.
Right. So just to make sure I've got that, this isn't a matter of one animal or creature looking at another and imputing a mind to that other and being aware of that other person as a subject. It is the sense, what you write at one point, I recognize the other as a subject to which I appear as an object. So it's being conscious of myself as an object that others are seeing or being aware of, right?
That's right. Yes, that's correct.
So again, my question with that is, well, let me give a concrete example. This is a rather lovely episode of Reading Our Times because you've got a dog in your room and I've got a young and rather cross kitten in my room, and I'll explain why it's cross.
Yes,
well, I'll explain why
that.
It's cross towards the end. This is a fortuitous timing of the interview for reasons that will become clear. But I see my cat with a mouse. The mouse is very, very clearly aware that it is the object of the cat's attentions.
Right.
And I'm sure if one could physiologically measure the mouse, that would be confirmed.
Yes.
But again, I'm not sure I want to impute to the mouse the kind of other awareness that is central to personhood.
Well, it depends then which kind of other awareness you think is central to personhood. The basic idea for the importance of non-intentional awareness, whether of self or other, is that is a much better candidate for explaining personhood than reflective awareness. So there's a problem which became known as the just more content objection. Suppose there are two mental states going on in my mind, a belief and another belief, let's suppose. And you want to say, well, they're both mine, they're both part of me. What unifies them? Because you may have the same belief, It's in your head, my beliefs are in my head. You may have the same beliefs, but your beliefs and my beliefs are not unified. They don't belong to the same individual. So then the idea is, well, what could make something belong to the same individual? The answer is, well, it can't be reflective self-awareness. Reflective self-awareness is a distinct act from the beliefs. It's a separate mental act. And so if you invoke that, then you have the question of, well, what unifies this act with the beliefs? So whenever you introduce something that's distinct, you get essentially a regress problem. It's supposed to explain the unity of two things, but now you have to explain the unity of that act with
three things and then four things.
Yeah, precisely. So it has all the hallmarks of a sort of classic regress problem. Since non-intentional awareness is not separate, it's built into the act themselves, then it's not separate, and so you don't get the same kind of problems. So that's why I think non-intentional awareness is a better candidate for accounting for the unity of a person.
Yeah. Let me move on to the subject that we've danced around a bit in our conversation, which is language, because very often this conversation about animal personhood begins and ends with the question of language, and people point out that animals communicate, of course they do, all the time, but only humans have language. There's a really interesting example in your book about how a Japanese bird has combinatorial structures in its language, which had heretofore been assumed to be a uniquely human characteristic. So there's a real sense that other animals have forms of language that are similar to ours, right?
Yeah, I think that is correct. That's the way the wind is blowing. These things have been recently discovered. I'm not sure what I think about this, because even if it applied to the Japanese tit, then it would presumably not apply to other creatures. This would be a fairly rare occurrence. I mean, I'm far more inclined to think about language in another way. So certain human beings have decided, right, this is the hallmark of language. We've got to have recursive structure, combinatorial, all these sorts of things. And so they've adopted a certain proprietary conception of language based on what they think humans have. And they say, well, this is it. This is what you need to have language. And if you don't have it, you don't have language. I would just be inclined to reject that as just sort of baseless.
Speciesism.
Speciesism, yes. Cameron Buckner has, well, it's not a nice word, but it's a very useful one. Anthropofabulation, you know, where we sort of, we construct various scenarios about how we do things. And sometimes we don't even do things in that way, though in the case of language, we probably do. And we say, well, this is the way it has to be. You can only have such and such if you do it this way. And not only is that way often just hopelessly convoluted, and that we don't do it most of the time, but the elevation to a necessity, oh, well, this is the way it has to be done, it just has no sort of no basis.
So I can recognise that. I mean, I have to say, I do incline towards that point of view, but nonetheless, I do see how it can seem like an exercise of pulling a ladder up because we're at the top of it and we don't want any other animals to climb up. But I wonder, just pushing this point a bit further, I mean, at one point you say in the book, ultimately language is just another form of behaviour. I wonder whether that's the case, because doesn't language enable and facilitate an imaginative inner world which is by some reckonings very important to personhood, that isn't therefore accessible to other animals? Isn't language more transformative, I guess I'm saying?
Right, so language transforms our experiences into forms that animals could not have. I think that's quite likely to be true. But it's a non sequitur that from that it follows that animals are not persons unless you can show these new ways of experiencing essential to personhood. And that's the argument I've never seen.
So you recognise that language has a transformative effect like that, but as far as you're concerned, that doesn't impinge on this debate about personhood.
Yeah, I've not seen a convincing argument for thinking that it does. What's underlying these kinds of arguments usually are just a form of the human chauvinism. Oh, well, this is the way, you know. It has to be this way or it's not the genuine article at all.
Yeah. Let's draw our conversation to a close by looking at the consequences of all this. You say rather winningly in your last chapter, it's never really advisable when composing the closing stanza of an academic monograph to go all Dr. Doolittle on one's readership, which did make me smile. You conclude that recognition of the other as a person shifts the focus from a treatment paradigm to a listening paradigm. Explain what you mean by that.
Bernard Williams, who was a very good philosopher, once argued that the difference, and he thought of this as a moral difference between us and other animals, is that the only consideration that arises between us and them is how we should treat them. And I think that makes animals far less complicated and ingenious and wonderful than they actually are. There's a lot more to our dealings with animals and how we should treat them. Certainly if you understand treatment in a fairly sort of narrow way. Animals have lives of their own. They can make choices about how they want to live. So they have a certain kind of autonomy, if you like, which has gone unrecognized, I think, by many philosophers who've thought about these issues.
And the listening paradigm is one in which we pay more attention to what their desires are rather than simply treating them.
Precisely, yeah.
Yeah. So that allows me to reintroduce my grumpy cat.
Yes, I'm dying to find out why she's grumpy.
Well, she was spayed yesterday. So we got her after 7 months, I think. She was 7 months old. It was rather a hasty purchase. And we were told that unless you want kittens, you've got to have her spayed. So we did.
Yeah.
And, you know, not a very nice thing. And she's, you know, I think she's very upset with us and just upset with the world today. We did this, I guess, a week or so after I read the book, and I was kind of feeling guilty yesterday. I'm feeling guilty today because she's clearly very upset with life.
Yeah.
This comes across as slightly facetious. I certainly don't mean it to be. But by your logic, I shouldn't have done that, really, because there's no conceivable way she would have wanted to be spayed. But I treated her in this way in order that she could remain our cat. If we do recognise animal personhood, I've done something wrong there.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the idea is sometimes you can do wrong things because they're the least wrong things. My dog got extremely grumpy. I had him neutered as well, largely because his testicles hadn't dropped. But he spent the next few days in a sort of concerted effort to kill me. You know, you've done this to me. And in one sense, yeah, perhaps I shouldn't. But on the other hand, undescended testicles tend to lead to cancer. So there's a wrong, but there's a greater wrong that it avoids. And it would be unfeasible for you, presumably, if your cat were to have kittens all the time. That would be
certainly
a good thing.
Unfeasible for my wife. That would be the end.
Precisely. So it can probably be handled on the sort of wrong versus great or wrong kind of account.
After 4 or 5 years, this is the first episode of Reading Our Times where we've ever discussed the reproductive organs of dogs and cats. But I'm very glad we have, because it's been a fascinating discussion. The book is called Can Animals Be Persons? Mark Rowlands, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Thank you very much, Nick. Thanks.
Next week, I'll be speaking to Abigail Schreer about her book, Bad Therapy, Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up.
Especially in the United States, we give people unhealthy lives and then we pour in mental health resources expecting it to cure everything. And it doesn't. They end up more miserable but on 10 psychiatric drugs.
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and you can also find us on the website theosthinktank.co.uk. We're going to be doing a few live events at festivals in the coming months, so please sign up to the Theos monthly newsletter and join us in person for those if you can. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It'll help other people find it. Goodbye.